It's 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific Standard Time. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, and we are streaming live online at freakradio.org. That's freak as in F-R-E-A-K, radio.org. This is the Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, November 10, 2014. It's 3:01. And if that jives with your personal time-space continuum, then you know that the show is live. And you may call in at any time. Here is the phone number for the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Area code 831-427-3772. Again, that's area 831-427-3772. 427-3772. 427-3772. That area code 831 is good for Santa Cruz County here on the far left coast of North America, in Ecotopian, California, USA. My name is Ren Tawil, and let's have a little opening inspirational music for you, Stuart Davis.
Ocean is pristine. It is the spirit realm, and you are at the helm, where all the hungry souls convene. Your instruments are gauged for motion. Don't tie the craft, you'll keep it still. Rip the captain's idol, then the ship is bridled. You have a voyage to fulfill. This vessel harbors no one mean, timid never seek. Watch the water rise, you have anxious eyes. There is a compass in your chest.
You told the house of life.
There is a purpose you possess.
You told the house of life.
Every drop and every crest. I know your sails are full and tight.
You told the house of life.
Some may embrace their hesitations and the passive anchors that they lay. But retrospect will prove those who never move become a pirate's easy prey. This boat is the sum of all your actions. Its body is a product of your deeds. Crossing water fast. Is the mast, you were christened with God's speed. The frightened ones who wouldn't board envy you from shore. You're in the rising tide, you are in your eyes. There is a compass in your chest.
See you toward the house of life.
There is a purpose you possess.
See you toward the house of life.
With every drop and every crest, I see sails are full and tight.
Seen toward the house of light.
You are immersed in affirmation. By a dimmer glow, drown in the undertow. But you are centered in a higher conscious plan. You see the beacon clearing bright. There is a compass in your chest.
See you toward the house of light.
There is a purpose. You
house of light.
House of Light from Stuart Davis's, Minnesota's very own Stuart Davis, his third album entitled Self Untitled. 1994, Panacea Records. Again, that was House of Light by Stuart Davis. Trying to start this program on an upbeat, positive note, considering what I'm about to get into. This is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Lawrence Tuwiel. You can call me Ren. I am a Palestinian American, and I need to get back into the habit of reminding people of that at the very beginning of every Mideast Migraine Show. I am Palestinian American. My father was a born and bred Jerusalemite. He was fortunate enough, for the sake of his own skin, to be out of his country and here in the U.S. on the 14th of May, 1948, which is the date when the modern Jewish state of Israel was declared. I say fortunate because, for one thing, his brother, who was also his business partner, was killed by Zionist partisans simply because his brother, Wadia, tried to enter a warehouse which contained his own property, his business, his livelihood. And the building, the property, was absconded by the new Israeli government, and they declared that Wadia had no right to enter it, even though it was his property and his business to begin with, and they killed him. I also have, my dad also had a cousin who was out in the country on his farm. He and his family were essentially chased off of the property at an earlier date, and when his cousin tried to go back and claim his right to remain in his house on his land, he was beaten to death by the Zionist partisans. Dad was not able to return. This is the part about him being lucky to save his own skin. He was in the United States in California in May of 48, and because of what transpired in the old country, his ancestral home, he was not permitted to return, ever. Or at least he, instead of making any effort at a later date to at least visit, and visit any members of his family who remained there that he still had ties with, he chose to stay in California, marry an American woman, and raise my three sisters and myself. I'm a native San Franciscan myself, and so that's what that's about. This program makes no pretense of providing a painstakingly objective look at the situation in Palestine and Israel. I clearly want to provide a truthful, straightforward program presenting Palestinian sentiment and the Palestinian narrative on what is going on. This is, in spite of the happy music that I just finished playing, a rather sad day, but probably not a surprise to anyone who's been following this. A woman named Razmia Odeh, a native Palestinian Arab, who had been living for many, many years in the United States, I believe in Michigan, is someone who, in her old country, experienced the horror of being held by Israeli authorities, was subjected to torture, and believe you me, Israeli military and other state authorities do commit torture. I suspect that many people who count themselves among those in the Israeli camp, the pro-Israeli crowd, pro-Zionist crowd, have a tendency to say, no, Israelis do not torture. Amnesty International, B'Tselem, and many, many other neutral, or at least reasonably neutral authorities, many of them have reported the fact that Israel commits torture on many of its prisoners, including minors, 18, 17 years or younger. And on occasion, the Israeli authorities have even admitted this. Razmiya Odeh, a woman who, while still living in the old country, was tortured by her Israeli jail keepers and raped multiple times. And now she has been sentenced by an American court for false, I was just reading it here, false procurement of American citizenship based on false information on her original application for U.S. citizenship. Let me just read you. Come on. Oh, God. Oh, here it is. This is from Mondevice on the web. In travesty of justice, Razmiya Odeh found guilty despite history of Israeli torture. From the Mondevice editors, November 10, that's today, folks. The following statement was issued by the Razmiya Defense Committee. In a travesty of justice, Razmiya Odeh today was found guilty of one count of unlawful procurement of naturalization. For over a year, Razmiya, her supporters, and her legal team have been battling this unjust government prosecution, saying from the start that the immigration charge was nothing but a pretext to attack this icon of the Palestine Liberation Movement. And that, of course, would be here in the U.S., in Detroit, in Michigan. Continues, and although there is real anger and disappointment in the jury's verdict, it was known as early as October 27 that she would not get a fair trial. On that day, Judge Gershwin Drain made a number of rulings that made her defense virtually impossible. The government's indictment stated that she had unlawfully gained U.S. citizenship because she had allegedly answered a number of questions falsely on her visa application in 1995 and her naturalization application in 2004. She had been in this country as a lawful permanent resident for almost 20 years and a resident for over 9 years when she was arrested on October 22nd of last year, 2013. The main basis for the arrest a year ago was that she had allegedly falsely answered no to a question asking whether she had ever been arrested or imprisoned. The U.S. government claimed, that she failed to disclose that she had been convicted by the Israelis of participating in bombings in 1969. This conviction in a military court, and that would be an Israeli military court, of course, was the result of a false confession made after she was viciously tortured and raped by Israeli military authorities for weeks. There is no due process in Israeli military courts which, in quotes here, convict over 99% of Palestinians who come before them, and, quote, evidence from these should not be accepted in a court in the U.S., according to this article by the editors of Mondevice. Continuing now. But Judge Drain did not allow the conviction in Israel to be entered into evidence. And even though he suggested that Razmi's assertion that she faced torture and sexual abuse at the hands of her Israeli captors was, quote, credible, he still ruled that it could not be brought up in the course of her trial. So her attorneys had to scrap plans to call to the stand an expert witness, clinical psychologist Dr. Mary Fabry, who has decades of experience working with torture victims, to testify that the allegedly false answers on the immigration forms were the result of Razmiya's chronic post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. The judge also rejected Razmiya's selective prosecution motion, even though it was clear that the case against her grew out of the investigation of 23 anti-war and Palestinian community organizers in Chicago and Minneapolis, my former hometown. As I said, I'm a native San Franciscan, but I lived in Minneapolis for 3.5 decades. It was clear that the case against her grew out of the investigation of 23 anti-war and Palestinian community organizers in Chicago and Minneapolis who were subpoenaed to a federal grand jury in 2010. Make no mistake, Razmiya came under attack by the U.S. government because she is Palestinian, and because for decades she has organized for Palestinian liberation and self-determination, the right of return, and an end to U.S. funding of Israeli occupation. Palestine support work, especially the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, or the BDS movement, has made a number of recent gains, and the long arm of federal law enforcement has attempted to crack down on it. Crack down on BDS and Palestine support work, like it has on all effective and impactful movements for social justice in the history of this country. The crackdown reached Razmiya. More than 200 people from across the Midwest, especially from Chicago, traveled to stand with her throughout the trial. They bore silent witness to her incredible testimony. For despite the judge's ruling, she and her defense team did put the crimes of Israel on record. Her story of being exiled from the village of her birth, Lifta, in 1948, of being exiled again during the 1967 war, of experiencing the death of her sister after the raid on her home in 69, and of being a political prisoner, one of the most famous in the history of the Palestine Liberation Movement. All these are stories of the crimes of apartheid Israel, crimes that continue today in the racist, settler, and military assaults we have seen in the Gaza Strip, Jerusalem, 1948 Palestine, and the West Bank. Israel's terrorism and the U.S. government's complicity were exposed for all the world to see. Razmiya's honesty in the face of cross-examination from Assistant U.S. Attorney Jonathan Tuchel was thoroughly convincing as well. She said clearly that she thought the questions on the immigration forms were being asked about her time in the U.S. because she said she had nothing to hide and did not need to lie. She had testified about her torture at the United Nations when she was released in 1979, and as her lead attorney, Michael Deutsch, said, quote, "It was well known that she was convicted and traded in the prisoner exchange. The U.S. Embassy knew it, the State Department knew it, and immigration should have known it," end quote. So although the government had to prove that she, quote, knowingly lied, it never met that burden, regardless of what the verdict says. For over a year, the Razmiya Defense Committee has been organizing educational events, rallies, protests, and call-in days to demand that U.S. Attorney Barbara McQuaid and Tuchel drop the charges against her. We now have more work ahead of us. Razmiya's brilliant legal team, Deutsch, Jim Fennerty, Bill Goodman, and Dennis Cunningham, will undoubtedly file an appeal and have strong grounds to do so based on Judge Drain's unjust decisions. And we will continue to support their work with our political organizing and mobilizations. Just like our people in Palestine and across the world will never rest until 1 inch of historical Palestine is free, until every inch of historical Palestine is free, we will never rest in our defense and support of Razmiya as she moves forward to challenge this conviction. As Deutsch said in his closing statement to the jury, "It has been one of the great privileges of my long legal career to represent this extraordinary woman of great passion and dignity." Razmiya's story is the story of millions of Palestinians, of millions of freedom-loving defenders of justice everywhere. Her eventual victory will be a victory for Palestine and for all the people's movements across the world. Today, we thank everyone who stood with Razmiya this past year and ask you to continue fighting with us until we achieve that victory. And again, this story of the events of today, November 10, 2014, that Razmiya O'Day was found guilty of, and I'll say it allegedly, lying on an immigration form, was presented by Mondovice.net. I believe they're a .net. Mondovice, by the way, is spelled M-O-N-D-O-W-E-I-S-S. Mondo is in World Vice, as in Philip Vice, the editor-in-chief of this Middle East reporting institution. Now, the writers said, "We support and we do this and we do that," obviously they're speaking for those at Mondo Vice. So clearly they too are a very strong Palestine liberation sentiment. They certainly make no mistake about it, as neither do I. Okay, now, if I can read another story. And this is, oh my, how things change. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee condemns the selective prosecution and conviction of Palestinian American community leader Razmiya O'Day. The name, by the way, is spelled R-A-S-M-E-A. Last name O'Day, O-D-E-H, Washington, D.C., November 10. Palestinian American activist and community leader Razmiya O'Day was found guilty today of unlawful procurement of naturalization. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, the ADC, is strongly concerned that Ms. O'Day's selective prosecution is part of a government strategy to intimidate and silence advocates who speak out for Palestinian and human rights, particularly through use of nonviolent means such as the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS movement. Ms. O'Day allegedly committed immigration fraud on her immigration forms in 1995 because she did not report her alleged conviction. Her conviction by an Israeli military court that used sexual torture to extract a confession from her. In other words, they only seem to care about the conviction by a foreign court, a military court, which does not have all the rights for prisoners as a civil court would, more interested in the conviction than they were about the torture and rape that she endured. Continuing here with the statement, the prosecution brought an indictment against O'Day in 2013, 9 years after she became a U.S. citizen and almost 20 years after she filled out her immigration forms. It is widely believed that Ms. O'Day was prosecuted not because of immigration concerns, but because of her political views, which can be viewed as the fact that they made her a political prisoner in the United States. Continuing here, which are supposed to be protected under the First Amendment, her political views. She has been an outspoken anti-war community organizer and proponent for Palestinian liberation, self-determination, and ending United States funding of Israeli occupation. Ms. O'Day is a political torture and rape victim. In 1969, Ms. O'Day was jailed, tortured, and sexually abused by Israeli authorities. During this time, Israeli authorities also attempted to force Ms. O'Day's father to rape her in order to coerce her confession. Ms. O'Day spent 10 years in jail because of a confession that was illegally obtained by torture. Prior to Ms. O'Day's conviction, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, the ADC, wrote a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder and urged the Justice Department to stop its targeting of social activists such as Ms. O'Day. ADC reminded the Justice Department that torture is illegal under both U.S. and international law and urged the Justice Department to stop holding Israelis and Palestinians to separate standards. ADC is greatly disappointed that the Justice Department continued to prosecute Ms. O'Day and ignored her victory, ignored her history as victim of torture. Judge Drain allowed Ms. O'Day's alleged conviction by Israeli military authorities to be entered into evidence. He allowed the alleged conviction by Israeli military authorities to be entered into evidence, but did not allow an expert witness to testify regarding Ms. O'Day's post-traumatic stress disorder that resulted from her torture and sexual abuse. ADC strongly believes that Ms. O'Day was subjected to a selective prosecution because of her political views. Ms. O'Day's actions as a community leader to bring about political, social, and economic change are supposed to be protected activity under the Speech, Assembly, Association, and Petition clauses of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. ADC urges law enforcement agencies to stop discriminating against community activities, to stop discriminating against community activists based on their political views and targeting those who are actually contributing to the betterment of our society. End of today's statement by the ADC. I have been supplied faithfully by those who stay on top of Rasmia O'Day's case and impending conviction over the many weeks of her trial and all the pauses in between actual trial dates. I've been made privy to the details all this time. If I were still in Minnesota, I may have been in a position to have been present at the venue of her trial and to add my presence and voice to those who were standing up for her. Now being in California, that is was far less likely anyway. At any rate, based on the reading of those dispatches I've been receiving, it was clear that this was going to happen. It is not by any means the first time that Palestinians and Palestinian Americans in the United States have been hushed up, intimidated, subjected to legal abuse because they were targeted for their pro-Palestine, pro-peace, and pro-justice activities here in the U.S. This is the most vivid example of this kind of behavior in a number of years. But I'll bet you dollars to donuts you're not going to hear anything about it on the evening news. Maybe on Democracy Now. If not the TV version, then the radio version. Although I think they're not really separate versions. I'm not sure about that. Free Radio Santa Cruz does carry Democracy Now with Amy Goodman et al. In the mornings at 8 or 9. Got it in front of me here right now. Democracy Now at 8 to 9 a.m. and noon to 1 on Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM on your radio dial right now. And we are streaming live at freakradio.org. Now, except for the impending appeals, as this last piece indicated, or sure to happen, or was it the Mondavice piece? At any rate, its appeals will be made as to whether or not they will be followed upon by the U.S. legal system is another story. But short of those appeals, that's it for now on the story of Rasmea O'Day. It's 3:32 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. This is the Mideast Migraine Show, which comes to you twice a week. This, the Monday version, two separate shows, every Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 1500 hours, and the other, Mideast Migraines, the Saturday edition, at 11 a.m. on Saturday. Both shows are about 2 hours long. The 11 a.m. edition of Mideast Migraine Show, of course, for the past year, has been dedicated to the readings of recent, or at least contemporary, major writings about the Palestine-Israel situation and items directly related to that. I just finished the last, two Saturdays ago, I finished a 3-day reading from a short booklet entitled Reframing Anti-Semitism, Alternative Jewish Perspectives, talking to a large degree about the use and abuse, the abuse of the whole matter of making allegations that certain people are anti-Semitic, that they hate Jews, that they're disrespectful of the Jewish faith. And of course, in the minds of many people, this automatically translates into you are anti-Semitic if you are anti-Israel. If you criticize Israeli policies, you automatically hate Jews, is what they say. If you declare yourself to be an anti-Zionist, that is nothing short of anti-Semitism. And that is a very important distinction, that they are not equivalent in definition by many, many people for a very, very long time. In fact, it has been impressed upon people that it is vital to make a distinction between being anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist. So I read this anthology of 8 separate articles, each and every one by a Jewish author, about that whole matter. And then last Saturday, I just spent the day reading from and talking about a couple of major historic articles, or one major historic article written by Zionism's premier founder, Theodor Herzl, from the 1890s, the Great Convention took place, 1897 in Switzerland. And so I gave a very, very quick overview of his statement that was written the year before that conference, called Der Judenstaat, or The Jewish State, written in German, translated into English. And I read a couple of other pieces which went into the history and definitions of Zionism, what Zionism is and is not. One of them clearly was slanted towards sanctifying and justifying Zionism. But it was interesting nonetheless. And even they went to great lengths in the course of the article to talk about a great many definitions for Zionism, admitting the fact that many, many people had a diversity of opinion about what Zionism really is and what it should be and how it applies to the foundation of a national home in Palestine for the Jews of the world. Well, if you want to hear that show, go to my archives. They're on two separate websites, radioforall.net, that's R-A-D-I-O, the number 4, A-L-L.net, radioforall.net, type in Mideast Migraines, and see the recent dates, they're listed chronologically anyway, according to when I file them at the archive, and you'll be able to hear those programs at your leisure on your online device. The other internet website is Santa Cruz Indie Bay, I-N-D-Y-B-A-Y, the Indie Bay Internet Service, which caters to a number of communities, including San Francisco and Santa Cruz. Specifically, go to the Santa Cruz Indie Bay website. Click on Palestine. Also, check the long green box on the right margin of the page for recent airings of the Mideast Migraine Show, and you may hear these programs that you missed or want to hear them again. Just can't stay away. Just can't get enough Mideast Migraines, right? And there you have that. Now, along the lines of what I was talking about last Saturday, I want to continue talking about Zionism today, at least a little bit, and then I'll get back to that topic in more depth next on next Saturday's 11 a.m. edition of Mideast Migraines. That's 1100 hours Pacific time, of course. Okay, in order to do that, I better go to the right folder here. This is Ren Tawil, and you're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Let me just start with a bit of what I admit is a somewhat scattershot approach to understanding Zionism from rents.com. That's R-E-N-S-E. No relation to me. Rents.com. Disturbing quotes from leading Zionists. And this is actually extracted more immediately from Wikipedia. I know many people are critical of Wikipedia, questioning its reliability, etc. But you listen to these quotes and you consider them and tell me if you think they're bogus or not, or whether or not you think they truly apply or not. Don't forget, the phone number here to the studio is area code 831-427-3772, 427-3772. Let me just take a quick look here and see who all is listening. I can do that, you see. I have the magic box, which at least tells me who's listening online, or gives me an idea of how many people are listening online anyway. Of course, there's no way for me to know how many of you are listening within the city limits of Santa Cruz on just listening to the radio, but for online listeners, it's good to know that you're out there. Okay. It says here, there are some pretty choice quotes from shockingly honest Zionists. Here's a long piece. It's not clear to me at the moment who... Okay, here we go. Yeah. Starting the quotations. Quote, "We came here to a country that was populated by Arabs, and we are building here a Jewish state. Instead of the Arab villages, Jewish villages were established. You even do not know the names of those villages. And I do not blame you because these villages no longer exist, referring to the Arab villages, of course. There is not a single Jewish settlement that was not established in the place of a former Arab village, end quote. That was said by Moshe Dayan, founding Zionist and general in the early Israeli army, stated on March 19, 1969, in a speech at the Technion in Haifa, quoted in Haaretz, April 4, 1969. Haaretz is Israel's leading main premier regular periodical, news periodical. I find it interesting that he says there is not a single Jewish settlement that was not established in the place of a former Arab village. That is patently false. He might have been misquoting himself or just speaking out of his ass. Early on, the various kibbutzim, Jewish settler kibbutzes, were established independent from the Arab villages, existing Arab villages. But after the main purge of the Arab population, three quarters of 1 million Palestinian Arabs in 1948, and then several hundred thousand more in 1967, there were the first thing that the Jews of this nascent Israeli state did was they eliminated somewhere between 500 and 900. I've heard a wide range of statistics on that. 500 to 900 evacuated, refugeed villages from which their former residents became refugees, Arab villages. 500 to 900 that were bulldozed to the ground, laid waste, more or less empty former communities of Arabs. And that was really done so the Arabs did not have a community to come back to, would not have a village or a town or a city to come back to. And in place of those bulldozed villages, a number of either Jewish settlements or hospitals, center, treatment centers, commercial interests, and of course military bases sprung up. So he's lying there about that. Here's another statement. Again, I'm reading from this collection of disturbing quotes from leading Zionists. Quote, I better make sure this is okay. I read you the quotation from Moshe Dayan. I believe this is now further elaboration about what was going on. The State of Israel was built after a movement called Zionism. The term Zionism first came to public attention as a result of the works of Viennese Jewish journalist Theodor Herzl, whom I mentioned earlier, who argued in his 1896 book, Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State, which I also referred to earlier, that the best way of avoiding anti-Semitism in Europe was to create an independent Jewish state or national homeland. And parenthetically, it says here he was originally thinking of Uganda in Africa or South America. The movement eventually culminated in establishing the State of Israel in 1948 in Palestine, in the Arab world. Some 700,000 Palestinians became refugees. I think that's actually closer to being over 750,000 Palestinians became refugees. And a similar number of Jews arrived in the new state. Since then, the term Zionism properly refers to supporters of the Israeli state. I'll read that again. Since then, since the replacement of native Arabs by new Jews, non-native Jews, not native to Palestine. Since then, the term Zionism properly refers to supporters of the Israeli state, not to be equated with being pro-Palestinian Semitic or purely pro-Jewic, just as being anti-Zionism is not the same as being anti-Semitic. Okay, and let me continue to read this. The term racism refers to discriminatory beliefs and practices that presume inherent and significant differences exist between different human races. That assume these traits can be measured on a scale of superior to inferior, and that can result in the social, political, and economic advantage of one group in relation to others. In November 1975, the United Nations General Assembly Resolution 3379 declared that, quote, Zionism is a form of racism and racial discrimination, end quote. That was November 75. In December 1991, the General Assembly rescinded this resolution through Resolution 4686. And I should point out that that clearly had an awful lot to do with the fact that George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush 41, President Bush, was going to war to expel the Iraqi army from Kuwait, the Arab nation of Kuwait, and as I recall, in order to placate Israel and maintain their cooperation with this more or less fine-tuned military endeavor, Bush did what he could to browbeat the UN into causing the rescindment of the earlier resolution, 3379. Continues to say here, at the time, the Soviet Union, a major sponsor of the Zionism is racism doctrine, or Zionology, had completed its rapid collapse. The Soviet Union had completed its rapid collapse. I suppose Bush's action was also riding on the fact that the Soviet Union was imploding. It says here, Israel made revocation of Resolution 3379 a condition of its participation in the Madrid Peace Conference. Aha, aha. That's fascinating. Okay, now, this is the little breezier part here. Just reading these point by point, some racist statements by main Israeli and Zionist figures. Quote, the Palestinians are like crocodiles. The more you give them meat, the more they want. End quote. That by Ehud Barak, Prime Minister of Israel at the time, August 28, 2000, reported in the Jerusalem Post, August of 2000. Quote, the Palestinians are beasts walking on two legs, said by Menachem Begin, I believe when he was Israel's prime minister, in a speech to the Knesset, Israel's parliament, quoted in Amnon Kapelioch, Begin and the Beasts, quote-unquote, New Statesman, 25 June 1982. Quote, the Palestinians would be crushed and... In a subquote, the phrase Palestinians, as though they don't really exist, the Palestinians would be crushed like grasshoppers, heads smashed against the boulders and walls. Said by an Israeli prime minister at the time, the name is left out for some reason, in a speech to Jewish settlers reported in the New York Times, April 1988, quote, when we have settled the land, all the Arabs will be able to do about it will be to scurry around like drugged cockroaches in a bottle. When we have settled the land, all the Arabs will be able to do about it is to scurry around like drugged cockroaches in a bottle. That was quoted from Rafael Eitan, Chief of Staff of the Israeli Defense Forces, reported in the New York Times, April 83. Quotation. How can we return the occupied territories? There is nobody to return them to. None other than Golda Meir, Prime Minister of Israel, March 1969. I'm not sure where she was coming from there. Is she inferring that the Palestinians do not really exist, so they are hence nobody to return occupied territories to? Is she referring to those who were refugeed not merely from the new state of Israel, but even from the balance of the Palestine, former Palestine mandate, and didn't even live in the territories? They went into Arab countries, and that's her way of seeing them as non-existent. How can we return the occupied territories? There is nobody to return them to. What did she mean by that? Quote, there was no such thing as Palestinians. They never existed. Golda Meir, June 1569. Quote, the thesis that the danger of genocide was hanging over us in June of 1967, and that Israel was fighting for its physical existence, is only a bluff, which was born and developed after the war. Now, this is a statement from Israeli general at the time, Matyahu Peled, quoted in Haaretz, 19 March 1972. If all goes well, I will be playing an interview in the latter half of the show, an interview with Peled's son, Miko Peled. So again, this is a statement from Israeli general in the 1967 war, which Israel thrust upon its neighbors and the Palestinians. Many remaining Palestinians turned them into refugees. Israeli general Matyahu Peled said, I'll say it again, General Peled was considered a hero, decorated war hero in the 67 war, and very soon after that, a short time after that war, he basically relented and turned away from being a Zionist militarist, retired from being a general, and became a pacifist. Not merely a pacifist, but an active seeker of peace with the Palestinians. Here's what General Matyahu Peled said, again, quote, the thesis that the danger of genocide was hanging over us in June 1967, and that Israel was fighting for its physical existence, is only bluff, which was born and developed after the war, end quote. That notion was born and stated after the war was over. Just, in other words, it was a bunch of Israeli Zionist propaganda. Okay, continuing with quotations. Ben-Gurion also warned in 1948, he said this, we must do everything to ensure that they, the Palestinians, never do return. End quote. Assuring his fellow Zionists that Palestinians will never come back to their homes. Quote, the old will die and the young will forget. New statement. We declare openly that the Arabs have no right to settle on even 1 centimeter of Eretz Israel, Hebrew for the land of Israel. Force is all they do or ever will understand. We shall use the ultimate force until the Palestinians come crawling to us on all fours, end quote. Said by Rafael Eitan, Chief of Staff of the Israeli Defense Forces. I believe the reporter's name was Gad Becker from the Yediot Aronot 13 political party, Yediot Aronot political party, 13 April 1983, New York Times, April 1983. Another one here, quote, we must do everything to ensure they, the Palestinian refugees, never do return. Repeated by David Ben-Gurion in his diary, 18 July 1948, quoted in Michael Bar Zohar's Ben-Gurion, The Armed Prophet, Prentice Hall, 1967, page 157. Quote, we should prepare to go over to the offensive. Our aim is to smash Lebanon, Transjordan, and Syria. The weak point is Lebanon, for the Muslim regime is artificial and easy for us to undermine. We shall establish a Christian state there, and then we will smash the Arab Legion, eliminate Transjordan. Syria will fall to us. We then bomb and move on and take Port Said, Alexandria, and Sinai, end quote. Of course, those last three are all in Egypt, Port Said, Alexandria, and the Sinai Peninsula. That was said by David Ben-Gurion, May 1948, to the General Staff. From Ben-Gurion, a biography by Michael Ben-Zohar, Delacorte, New York, 78. Certainly, basically, a lot of those things did not happen. There was still very much Assyria, fragmented in pieces as it is. And the center point of current U.S. media concentration on that part of the world. Lebanon is still there. It had a several decades long, in effect, decades long civil war between Christians and Muslims and among Muslims and amongst various Muslim factions. The term Transjordan refers to the Jordanian state east of the Jordan River. But even though those things didn't necessarily happen, the point is Ben-Gurion, David Ben-Gurion, the founder, effective on the ground at the time, founder of the modern state of Israel, these were his intentions. This was his prescription on how to deal with the Arabs, both inside Israel and out. Smash Lebanon, Transjordan, and Syria. Little sneeze there. Oh, there goes the voice. That's really hard on the old voice box when you sneeze. Little recovery throat spray there. New prebiotic. I wonder what I'm going to buy to replace that bottle when it's empty. I think it helps. Okay, where was I? This Ben-Gurion quotation here. As he put it, our aim, or at least his aim, was to smash Lebanon, Transjordan, and Syria, holding the existing, at the time, Lebanese government in contempt, declaring openly that the Israeli Zionists, will establish a Christian state there. That's not news to me. I've come across a bunch of information that not only this was just something said off the top of his head, Ben-Gurion's head at the time, but the Israeli government, their Knesset, passed a number of resolutions declaring their support for turning Lebanon, establishing at the core of Lebanon's government a pro-Christian state. This is Israel determining for another nation how they're going to run their affairs. Israel must have thought at the time that a Christian state in Lebanon would, for one thing, reduce the status of Muslims there, so Israel would feel less threatened from the north. For a possible other thing, it might draw Palestinian Christians away from unfavorable living conditions in the Jewish state or in the occupied territories. But this is going back to 48. Okay, probably it might have Ben-Gurion's idea might have been to draw Christian Palestinians into Lebanon and out of his way. Smash the Arab Legion. The Arab Legion refers to Arab volunteers from within and without Palestine in 1948, who came to Palestine to defend it against Zionist aggression. To eliminate Transjordan, I believe that is, of course, utilizing a military method, would politically eliminate Transjordan as a serious enemy to Israel. Or maybe he was talking about actually taking over Transjordan, because this is what many Zionists, this is how many early Zionists people who looked to the creation of a Jewish homeland state, how they saw Jordan, which was referred to as Transjordan, meaning trans the Jordan River, across the Jordan River, part of Palestine. The original British occupying authority actually combined Jordan with Palestine and called it Transjordan. And the Jewish interpretation of the Balfour Declaration was that all of that land must fall to them, must fall to Jewish control. And that is not how I read the Balfour Declaration, nor do I give the Balfour Declaration such carved in stone legitimacy as those Zionists would give it. And same thing with Syria. Ben-Gurion said, Syria will fall to us. I guess he wanted to take over Syria too. And then he says, then we will bomb and move on and take Port Said, Alexandria, and Sinai. This man was clearly a kind of self-appointed new King David. One may even refer to him as a little Hitler. He was looking to expand and to Zionize all those geographic parts surrounding Palestine. Okay, let's move along. More from these quotations, as it is entitled, Disturbing Quotes from Leading Zionists. We must use terror, assassination, intimidation, land confiscation, and the cutting of all social services to rid the Galilee of its Arab population, said by Israel Koenig, taken from the Koenig Memorandum, K-O-E-N-I-G, King, the Koenig Memorandum. We must use terror, assassination, intimidation, land confiscation, and the cutting of all social services to rid the Galilee of its Arab population, the Galilee being the extreme northeastern corner of Palestine. Quote, Jewish villages were built in the place of Arab villages. Now we have a contradiction to the earlier quotation from that other dude. This was said by the same guy, Moshe Dayan. One of the first pieces I said was Dayan declaring that, no, not one Jewish village ever replaced an Arab village. Now he's saying, and I quote, Jewish villages were built in the place of Arab villages. You do not even know the names of these Arab villages, he says here, and I do not blame you because geography books no longer exist. Obviously referring to original Arab scripted geography books. He says, there is not a single place built in this country that did not have a former Arab population. The very reverse of his first statement, there is not a single place built in this country that did not have a former Arab population. Moshe Dayan addressed to the Technion Haifa, reported in Haaretz, April 4, 1969, and that first statement was April 4th, 1969, quoted in Haaretz. He goes from, flies the whole spectrum here of contradicting himself. First he says, no, we didn't replace the Arab villages. And then in the very, not only on the same date, but in the very same speech, the Technion in Haifa, he says, we did replace the Arab villages. There is not a single place built in this country, Israel, that did not have a former Arab population. New quotation. We walked outside, Ben-Gurion accompanying us, David Ben-Gurion accompanying us. Alon repeated his question, what is to be done with the Palestinian population? Ben-Gurion waved his hand in a gesture which said, the gesture said, drive them out. That was a statement from Yitzhak Rabin, another former Israeli prime minister, leaked censored version of Rabin memoirs. The leaked censored version of his memoirs published in the New York Times, 23 October 1979. We walked outside. This was during the fighting. And this was mentioned in Max Blumenthal's book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. During or in a lull from Israel's attack on the population of Ramleh and Lida, we walked outside. David Ben-Gurion accompanying us. Alone repeated his question, what is to be done with the Palestinian question? Ben-Gurion waved his hand in a gesture which said, drive them out. Said by Yitzhak Rabin. And, a post-quotation explanation that basically is what I just said. That was Rabin's description of the conquest of Lida. Or Lida, after the completion of Plan Dalit. Quote, we shall reduce the Arab population to a community of woodcutters and waiters, end quote. That quote from Yuri Lubrani, Prime Minister Ben-Gurion's special advisor on Arab affairs, 1960. We shall reduce the Arab population to a community of woodcutters and waiters. From The Arabs in Israel by Sabri Girjas. Here's a longer quotation. There are some who believe that the non-Jewish population, even in a high percentage, within our borders will be more effectively under our surveillance. And there are some who believe the contrary, which is to say that it is easier to carry out surveillance over the activities of a neighbor than over those of a tenant. I tend to support the latter view and have an additional argument. The need to sustain the character of the state, which will henceforth be Jewish, with a non-Jewish minority limited to 15%. I had already reached this fundamental position as early as 1940, and it is entered in my diary, end quote. That was said by Joseph Weitz, head of the Jewish Agency's Colonization Department. From Israel, an apartheid state by Yuri Davis, page 5. Now we're getting into stuff that Ariel Sharon said. And I quote, everyone has to move, run, and grab as many hilltops as they can to enlarge the settlements, because everything we take now will stay ours. Everything we don't grab will go to them, end quote. Ariel Sharon, Israeli foreign minister at the time, addressing a meeting of militants from the extreme right-wing Tzomet Party. Agence France-Presse, November 15, 1998. He was saying this towards the capping off of peace talks between Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat. So while they were preparing... While the peacemakers, as we understood them to be at the time, were preparing to finalize agreements, at least in the initial phase of implementing the Oslo Accord, the soon-to-be-doomed Oslo Accord, and arriving at some initial equal land swaps, there's Sharon running around saying, oh, we, the Jews and the Jewish settlers, have to move, run, and grab as many hilltops as we can to enlarge the settlements, which is exactly what they ended up doing. They concentrate on the high ground, on the hilltops, so that they can throw their garbage down, literally, and wash their sewage, literally, down the hills onto the Arabs, because that's what they do. Because everything we take now will stay ours. Everything we don't grab will go to them. The man is talking about land that was taken by the Arabs by force of arms in a surprise attack in 1967, continued to be held onto illegally according to international law, UN law, the Geneva Conventions. Israel continued this illegal occupation of what was supposed to be free Palestine, and which means... obviously, that all of that land ostensibly must go to the Palestinians. It was less than a quarter of original Palestine anyway, and here is Sharon saying, we still need to grab as much of that as we can. Already being held by us against the law, let's expand this illegal activity. Okay. New quotation, "It is the duty of Israeli leaders to explain to public opinion, clearly and courageously, a certain number of facts that are forgotten with time. The first of these is that there is no Zionism, colonialization, or Jewish state without the eviction of the Arabs and the expropriation of their lands." I want to make sure you understand that. What it is he's talking about. Quote, "It is the duty of Israeli leaders, their political leaders, to explain to public opinion, clearly and courageously," put that veneer on their face while they're saying it, "a certain number of facts that would otherwise be forgotten with time. The first of these is that there is no Zionism, colonization, or Jewish state without the eviction of the Arabs and the expropriation of their lands. Yoram Bar Porach of the Yediot Aronot right-wing political party, 14 July 1972. So he is admitting that the Jewish state did evict the Arabs and expropriate their land, and he's also advocating the absolute necessity for the Jews to lie about this and expect those facts to be forgotten in time. That's just what he said. All right. Next item. Quote, "Spirit the penniless population across the frontier by denying it employment. Both the process of expropriation and the removal of the poor must be carried out discreetly and circumspectly," end quote. End quote. Guess who said that, folks? None other than Theodore Herzl himself. Herzl, the founder of the World Zionist Organization, speaking of the Arabs of Palestine in his complete diaries, June 12, 1895 entry, I repeat it, "Spirit the penniless population across the frontier, the Arabs, by denying it employment." And then he went on to say, "Both the process of expropriation and the removal of the poor must be carried out discreetly and circumspectly." He did enjoy using certain flowery language, as though to give his quotations a certain justification. Quote, "1 million Arabs are not worth a Jewish fingernail," end quote. Said by Rabbi Yaakov Perin, February 1994. The source, New York Times, February 94, page 1. The front page. Quote, "We will establish ourselves in Palestine whether you like it or not. You can hasten our arrival or you can equally retard it. It is, however, better for you to help us so as to avoid our constructive powers being turned into a destructive power which will overthrow the world," end quote. Whoa. Chaim Weizmann, published in Judische Rundschau, number 4, 1920. "We will establish ourselves in Palestine whether you like it or not. You can hasten our arrival or you can equally retard it." Not sure who he was talking to, of course. "It is, however, better for you to help us so as to avoid our constructive powers being turned into a destructive power which will overthrow the world." Jesus Christe. I mean, you'd better assist the establishment of a Zionist Israel or we will kill you. And he directed that statement to the entire world. You know, folks, you can call me here at area code 831-427-3772, 427-3772, if you want to talk about any of this stuff. Maybe you want to set me right. If you dare. You can also say nice things to me. I'd certainly welcome that as much as I would welcome anything else constructive that you have to tell me. Let's try and finish this up. I want enough time for the interview with Miko Peled, the general's son. Okay, and there are a number of further quotational references here. Okay, I don't want to take up any more because this is a little too long. I'll probably read the whole thing again on the Saturday show, since we'll still be speaking about Zionism. Let's get to the Miko Peled interview. And here's hoping and praying that I can make this work. Assuming the sucker is going to cooperate with me. Why don't you enjoy a little more of Stuart Davis here? While I'm setting this up for you.
ruptured movement and chaotic rapture through means divorced from all tradition. The sweeping change was too abstruse, and the public spared him no abuse. Ridicule became a common mission. Time magazine said, look at law, this feeble and pathetic fraud. No one comprehended what automobile had transcended. Watch the gifted hands create motion in suspended state, where the sweet elation of true innovation harness the essence of life. Antiquated institutions always seem the hardest to subvert. Jackson was condemned to spend a lifetime throwing pearls into the dirt. John Cage's young intrepid is through the shackles of convention clear to better target man's potential. But the world assailed his pure device, is that a symphony or a poltergeist? Called lunacy his sole credential. Can hunger and abandon be fused into a synergy? That's where genius lies, covert to the cautious eye. Deep and fragile unity, the taste of immortality. And the mind unbound, that's when John had found that silence is married to sound. His departures were reviled, but the ignorant aren't easy to convert. John was still content to spend a lifetime to the dirt. Like the architect, unafraid to rupture, static orthodox with a brilliant structure, which the masses liable to sanction for the abstract style. It's broken ranks in that master builder. His ideas were so unyielding, kept his self-respect and lost his shit. But he pulls into the dirt, and progress may be painful, but the vanguard feel the greatest of the hurt. Let's all prepare to make our new pariah.
Okay, folks, rather than hearing from Mikko Pelled, his interview was just live today, this morning. This is from a new service featured by Ms. Katie Miranda. She calls it the Palestine Solidarity Telesummit. Daily interviews with major figures. On this program, I have already featured Palestinian American from the East Coast there, Massachusetts, comedian, journalist, and writer Remy Kanazi. That happened to be the very first interview in Miranda's Palestine Telesummit. I've played that. And I also, before that, however, I played the interview from someone whose name I cannot recall at the moment. And then the last one I had was Executive Director of Jewish Voice for Peace, Rebecca Vilcomerson. And again, those programs, Mideast Migraine programs featuring those interviews, are archived at radioforall.net, for being the number for radioforall.net, also at Santa Cruz Indie Bay. the names of the individuals interviewed appearing in the titles of those particular episodes of MM, most of them anyway. Instead of Mr. Peled, let's have one from a day or two ago. This, you'll be hearing from Nora Arakat. Nora Arakat is a former Palestine Liberation Organization negotiator. Let's go ahead and listen to this. It's about 38 and a half minutes long. Coming right up here.
Hi, welcome to the Palestine Solidarity Telesummit. I'm here with Nora Arakat, a Palestinian-American legal scholar, human rights attorney, and professor. So, Nora, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. I think it's important to mention that I am Palestinian-American. And so for many people, they ask, but what does that mean if you're Palestinian? Do you have paperwork? Because most Palestinians are stateless. In fact, my father is part of a generation whose residency in the West Bank was revoked during a campaign known as Secret Deportations, where it was revoked during his travels abroad, and he was never given the chance or the due process to challenge that. But part of, you know, the condition of being Palestinian is that condition of asserting that lineage, notwithstanding the ways that the legal and formal relationship has been severed. I'm a human rights attorney by training. I've worked on behalf of a Palestinian NGO called Bedil, the Palestinian Resource Center for Palestinian Refugee and Residency Rights, and represented them before the human rights treaty bodies, the different committees where we submit the shadow reports to counter the formal reports submitted by Israel. Mm-hmm. I've also represented them in the UN headquarters vis-a-vis diplomatic missions and U.S. Congress and the administration. I've worked in Congress as legal counsel for the subcommittee on domestic policy of the Oversight Government Reform Committee. I've also worked with an attorney in Lebanon on behalf of the Iraqi refugees who were subject to administrative detention. And I've engaged in a number of ad hoc grassroots projects in the United States with the community amongst Arab women, amongst Palestinians, and also formally as a national grassroots organizer and legal advocate for the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. So suffice it to say that I've spent the better part of my life engaged in this issue, in NGOs, in government, as well as in informal grassroots networks.
Wow, that's very, very impressive, Nora. So can you talk about the principles of distinction and proportionality in regards to humanitarian law in armed conflict? And how were those principles violated in the recent war on Gaza called Operation Protective Edge?
So humanitarian law is a large body of law that's comprised mostly of the Hague Regulations, 1899-1907, the Geneva Conventions of 1949, the additional protocols of 1977, as well as a number of conventions on safety, on the use of weapons, on the treatment of different treatment of the wounded and the sick and those not engaged in combat. So that's the body of law, and we can study it and discuss it. And then, you know, what in addition to that, there's customary international humanitarian law, which isn't legislated in treaties. Central to this discussion, right, are the principles of distinction and proportionality.
Okay.
Distinction is also something that's written into law and legislated in several places and mandates that belligerent forces distinguish between civilians who retain their immunity to be free from any kind of harm and combatants who both have the privilege, combatant privilege to kill and not call it murder, but also that if you kill a combatant, you can do that legitimately, and that's not murder either. You sign up to kill and to be killed in that situation. Then there's a status of non-combatant. So though that personnel that's associated with a belligerent force but aren't necessarily partaking in the fighting, mm-hmm. and those are the cooks, possibly the lawyers, the medical personnel on hand, and they also have immunity. So distinction prescribes that we, that an army must distinguish between the non-combatant and civilians, as opposed to combatants who can be targeted. Part of the problem is, in this situation that we're talking about, and one of the things that we have to accept is that collateral damage is acceptable, which is an awful way to say it, but the idea that if you are targeting a legitimate target, a combatant, and you happen to kill other civilians, that's acceptable. Mm-hmm. To the extent that, and this gets us into proportionality, to the extent that the military advantage achieved by targeting that combatant outweighs the harm done to the civilians. But in, there's no principle in law that says that civilians may never be killed. The principle is that they may never be targeted,
okay,
that you cannot target them. So this is invoked in two ways in the recent conflict. One of the ways is that Israel purported to say that it was only targeting military targets and legitimate combatant targets, so Hamas operatives, weapons, Hamas weapon salvos, and the rest of it, mm-hmm, but that Hamas actually hid those, hid its weapons in civilian infrastructure and hid itself or launched its operations from civilian neighborhoods, which then undermines this idea that it targeted the civilians, but instead was actually, it was Hamas's fault for doing that and therefore violating the prohibition on shielding, which requires demonstration of intentionality, and we can talk about that later. But the, that's the one, that's the first controversy that it comes up.
Mm-hmm.
The second controversy that comes up is Israel's redefining who's a legitimate target. And this is very dangerous because not only are we seeing that it's stretching the acceptable amount of incidental loss of civilian life, mm-hmm, but it's also saying that civilians, for example, who didn't flee after receiving a warning in something like a very unreasonable time, to flee in a situation in the Gaza Strip where there is nowhere to flee to, that that population then loses its civilian and immunity and becomes part of a legitimate target. And this gets us into another body of law of direct participation in hostilities, so that those civilians who participate in hostilities for short periods of time are actually legitimate targets as well. Mind you, though, that what Israel is trying to do in redefining who's a legitimate target based on that warning system is very novel, mm-hmm, in humanitarian law and very dangerous for eviscerating the protection that civilians have. That's one dimension of it. The other dimension is just asserting that every target, every hospital, every school, every ambulance, every home was actually a place of weapons storage for Hamas, which renders the entire population lacking of any immunity, mm-hmm, because it's saying, and even, you know, and what they've said explicitly, if the tunnel networks run throughout the Gaza Strip, then in fact, there is no place in Gaza that's safe if we are to accept that if theoretically Hamas did use these places to store weapons, then it's their fault that these civilians die, when in fact the law on the matter says to the contrary, that this doesn't free the opposing belligerent of its obligation to respect civilian life, mm-hmm, and that too, they still have to analyze whether the military advantage gained was proportionate to that civilian harm, which brings us to proportionality. So proportionality doesn't say that if I launch five, you know, rockets, Israel can shoot five missiles back. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do in a framework of ongoing hostilities, as opposed to a framework of the right to self-defense. Mm-hmm. But a framework of ongoing hostilities, it becomes a case-by-case basis of every military operation and every target. Was the harm incurred in that military operation so advantageous to the military force that it outweighed the loss of civilian life and the, mm-hmm, harm done unto civilian infrastructure? And that's a case-by-case analysis. To you and me and to most viewers, just looking at, you know, from a bird's eye view, the loss of 2,100 Palestinian lives, 504 children, 18,000 homes destroyed, 100,000 rendered homeless, the Seoul sewage, the largest sewage treatment plant destroyed, 15,000 tons of solid waste flowing into the streets of Gaza, and just a litany of awful things, we think, my God, that has to be disproportionate. Mm-hmm. But in fact, and you and I should argue that, I think that it is on its face disproportionate, or at least creates the presumption of disproportionality, which Israel has then, you know, must rebut as a matter of law, and which it refuses to because it doesn't want to be subject to any kind of oversight. But in law, that would have to be subject to a case-by-case analysis. And mm-hmm. and it's just something that hasn't been, because Israel considers that intelligence privileged, and privileged, you know, state, part of state privilege in its intelligence and intelligence gathering of what it does, and doesn't want to be subject to any kind of international oversight. Now, that does that mean that you and I can't say is a non-legal matter on the face of it, it's disproportionate? I would argue that it is. And we have several instances where Israel did target civilians, not mm-hmm. where they were incidental loss, but where they were the target. In Shuja'iyah, they were the direct target of what mm-hmm. soldiers have called revenge killings. In Khaza'a, the fleeing civilians were shot in the back with witnesses. That kind of targeting, the four boys,
yeah,
on Gaza's shore. I mean, it's going to be really hard for Israel to say that with all of its advanced weapons technology, it really thought that they were anything but four little boys playing soccer.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, I mean, it was four of them that were bombed, and people witnessed it. So there are several incidents that I think are just plain to see without any kind of inquiry. And then there are others which, as a legal matter, will be subject to a lot of debate. But, you know, just as without even the legal investigation, to say Israel hasn't accomplished its goals that it set out to, military goals it set out to accomplish, and yet, so you wonder, when would it have, and what mm-hmm. would it have cost, and is that proportionate to the outcome? I think the only way that you can rationalize that it's proportionate to the outcome is if you diminish the value of Palestinian life.
Yeah, wow. And when you mentioned, you know, taking a bird's eye view of the war, like, the first thing that popped into my head are all these, like, literal photos, like, bird's eye view photos of the whole place just flattened, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. Whole neighborhoods, whole cities just flattened. So...
But as a matter of law, and here's why people shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't depend too much on the law. As a matter of law, those photos don't necessarily tell us everything. Right? Mm-hmm. Because then we would have to, as a matter of law, now I would say that, you know, we should have other standards that judges whether or not the reasoning made any sense, because the slippery slope of Israel's argument was that the entirety of Gaza could be flattened for the sake of Israel's defense. And I think that we really need, part of what was missing is to scrutinize that logic.
Mm-hmm.
But if we took it, for example, before the ICC, it would have to be, you know, interrogated and judged. Okay, did the flattening of this particular neighborhood, was it worth, for example, the targeting of a particular Hamas target?
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes the analysis. So it's one of the reasons, despite my training as an attorney, you know, I say it's not that all that helpful, right?
Yeah. So during the war, Israel, and you talked about this a minute ago, Israel labeled civilians as non-civilians due to just their geographical location. Like, you know, maybe they were near a place where rockets were being launched. How is the Israeli government able to even make that claim and have it not go unchallenged?
So this reflects, I think it's not going challenged by media, and it's not going challenged by a lot of states. And I think this reflects, you know, media work and how Israel's lexicon about this issue has seeped and ingrained into a popular imaginary within the United States. I don't know that it was a similarly accepted worldwide. And so this idea that, you know, Netanyahu describing that the dead were telegenically used in order to, you know, it was part of the warfare and propaganda to just display the dead. I mean, this is all steeped in a dehumanizing discourse
mm-hmm.
that simultaneously demonizes Palestinians and removes any kind, exculpates Israel from its responsibility for that harm done. And it's, mm-hmm. it's a rhetorical tool that's used. The fact that it was not scrutinized by our media or by those, you know, in power, I think those in power, it just reflects, you know, their interest. This is the U.S. policy line. Had it challenged Israel publicly, it would have been subject to a domestic row and rebuke from Congress for mm-hmm. being so brazen. And in the media, I think that, you know, there's... it seeped into the lexicon where it's so normal. So
it
hits my ear and your ear as offensive and insane. Yeah. But for the average viewer who doesn't know much, right? Who, for them, Hamas is Islam,
ISIS.
Or ISIS at worst, right? And ISIS is, or I don't even want to bring that up because that's so silly, but Hamas is Islam and Islam is terrorist and terrorism. And so they're all just bad and they deserve what they get. For them who have no idea maybe where Israel is, that this isn't a religious conflict, that this is what about settler colonialism, it's not as jarring. Because you just take for granted that Palestinians aren't, you know, aren't human.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't think like you and me, right? They don't have the same considerations. They don't love their children in the same way. They don't fear death in the same way. They don't play in the same way. And so I think it's just that's part of the popular discourse that's been created. So this isn't just in warfare. This is well outside of the framework of war and how media facilitates these possibilities.
Yeah, well, that's a great answer to my question. It's very painful, but I'm afraid it's very true. So going back to the media, I was watching an interview with you and Chris Hayes on MSNBC. And if the listeners want to watch this video, I put it in a link. It's right below this video here. You can click on it and watch it. So Chris prefaced a question to you with the following statement, and this is a quote. As we've been reporting, 5 Palestinian deaths based on sources from Palestinian media there. We're still looking to confirm. So when he said this, I just had to pause there and take that in because no one ever says things like that about Israeli casualties. They never say, we're still looking to confirm. People just accept it as a given. So can you talk about how the mainstream media just assumes Israeli sources are credible, but Palestinian sources are not?
Well, I think that's self-evident in the question that you pose and how you pose it in the example that you cite. But let me comment about a few things around that. First, that wasn't a recent interview. That was done, in 2012.
Oh, okay.
And for the record, Chris Hayes has actually been more critical than, and so which tells you a lot, that if he's amongst the best on this issue and still having, because of the market demand and his viewer demand, that would push back to frame the question in that way, right? Because he's speaking to an audience that's not going to be receptive to anything that either criticizes Israel or presents Palestinians as equal or as possibly the victim. Right, so he's also mindful of his own audience and framing it in a way that is anticipating a certain type of pushback. But that says a lot. That says a lot about the work that's happening outside of these actual confrontations.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing about there's two sides of this coin. One is accepting Israeli narrative uncritically. And that reflects the acceptance of state power uncritically and whose state narrative we accept. So, for example, had it been China or Russia or Saudi Arabia, I think the way that they've been, maybe Saudi Arabia even less so, but definitely China and Russia, and let's say Syria, Iran, their state narrative isn't accepted uncritically because it doesn't comport with the U.S.'s own state narrative. And this reflects the consolidation of power and the way that is refracted through a media that both can't be too critical. Because if you're too critical as a media, you lose your privileges and your access to certain people with insider information. So you're caught in this catch-22. And also those that might, our media conglomerates that are owned, those owners also reflect certain interests. Mm-hmm. So there's never this unbiased, portrayal in the media that doesn't somehow, especially if it's that big and institutionalized, doesn't reflect state power and the consolidation of it. And so that's on the one hand, and it's especially why, new social media and the democratization of media has been absolutely critical to the shift that we're seeing in this discourse, because that's unhampered by these financial considerations. The second part of that coin of accepting Israel's narrative uncritically is the part of not trusting Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And that just doesn't happen just in the media. That happens even on a grassroots level in our communities. So, for example, one of the reasons I think that people were excited about seeing me and other Palestinians on television was less because of, hey, it's my friend, and more because it was, hey, they're letting Palestinians speak for themselves as trustworthy authorities. Mm-hmm. Right? That was major.
Yeah.
That was major. And that was part of the story of just even accepting Palestinians as trustworthy authorities, mm-hmm. even though the pushback on that was, for example, the labeling of us as pro-Hamas attorneys, or somehow the pushback was of being naive and not knowing what was in our own good. So in an interview, for example, somebody actually said to me, the Israeli deputy ambassador to the U.S. says to me, you know, why are you defending Hamas? You wouldn't be able to look like that if you were in the Gaza Strip. So this idea that somehow I'm duped and uh-huh. don't understand what's going on, and of course tapping into very racist discourse around Islam and gender, assuming that all Arabs are Muslim. But then there was the other part of it of, you know, even in communities, however, we don't often let Palestinians speak for themselves. Right? How many settings, and for the viewers watching, how many settings have you been in where there's a panel of Palestinians and there's pushback of you didn't include the other side, mm-hmm. right? Because how are we going to believe them? Or, for example, what we saw in several of the divestment votes and the debates, what we needed in order to make that compelling was to hear Jewish voices reiterate the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So this lack of trustworthiness of Palestinian sources, I think, is very endemic, and not just to places where corporate interest is involved, but it's even in a place where it's not involved. It's just the way that we've come to think of these mm-hmm. issues and who we come to think is the primary protagonist and then the secondary protagonist and how we think of that. And I think that informs the way we talk about it.
Yeah. So in that same interview with Chris Hayes, Jeremy Ben-Ami of the liberal Zionist lobby group J Street was also on the panel. And Jeremy used the phrases both sides or both people three times in 45 seconds. And we hear this phrase so often repeated by Zionists. And do you think this constant repetition of the phrase in the media is like a deliberate manipulation of language to bring the debate back to one that is of two equal sides and that's symmetric?
Well, I think that that's inherent just in the structure of the peace process, which creates a false parity that doesn't exist. Because mm-hmm. obviously there are two sides, but that doesn't mean that the two sides have an equal capacity to mete out harm, nor an equal capacity to take responsibility. And what's lost in that is that Israel has been a state since 1948. So even though, you know, it's framed as being under threat and that it's fighting for its survival and its self-defense, it has been the state. The only state in question since 1948 is the 11th most powerful army military power in the world and a nuclear power in the Middle East with the unequivocal support of superpower, the U.S., mm-hmm. in contrast to the Palestinians, who have been stateless since, you know, at least 1948 when, or 1950 when the Israeli citizenship, also known as the nationality law, revokes their nationality bestowed upon them in 1925 under the British mandate. And so, but they've been stateless. They've been living as colonial subjects under mm-hmm. Israel's settler colonialism, whether it be as those under occupation or those as second-class citizens or those in exile. And so we begin to discuss, it's perfectly accurate to say two parties. And it's perfectly accurate mm-hmm. to say two sides, because in fact, it's multidimensional. But it's completely inaccurate and misleading to imbue the partition of sides or parties with equal power that is just undue mm-hmm. because of the disparity of the power relations between them.
Yeah. So I feel like when I hear, you know, both sides, it is imbuing that phrase with, you know, kind of like some kind of equality or symmetricalness. So another phrase that we hear often in the media is Hamas uses civilians as human shields, and it's used over and over and over. And I actually did a Google search and it came up with over 500,000 references in Google. Mm-hmm. So despite no evidence that they did use civilians as human shields, this phrase has been repeated enough times so that people just believe it. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, this was something that came up in the debates that I did repeatedly. And on one of the programs, I actually was able to push back, and the host was able to push back as well to ask, what evidence do you have that Hamas is doing this? Mm-hmm. Because according to investigations, because Israel has used this in 1982 during the siege of Beirut, has used it in 1996 in its attack on the south of Lebanon, in Operation Grapes of Wrath, when it, you know, bombed a UNIFIL compound in Qana, has used this in 2006 in its face-off with Hezbollah, has used this again in 2008 and 9 with Hamas, and again in 2012. This is not new, mm-hmm. right? And so we've had the opportunity to investigate those allegations. The Goldstone Report, or the Human Rights Council, investigated it mm-hmm. in 2008 and 9. In its investigation of Operation Cast Lead, and found that while there were exceptional uses, well, this is true in some cases, it's not true as a matter of systematic. Hamas has not used this. Neither Hamas nor Hezbollah nor these different groups have used this tactic as a matter of systematic use, mm-hmm. where it's not central to the way they operate as a belligerent force or as a militant force. It's only exceptional uses of it, right? And so Human Rights Watch did a similar investigation in 2006 in Lebanon. Amnesty International did similar investigations. What's mind-boggling is that despite the fact that Israel refuses to subject itself to an impartial investigation because it believes that anybody but itself is biased, right? And that's mm-hmm. why we see the Charcot Commission be the state of exception, right? Is that despite Israel refusing to subject itself to some sort of scrutiny, and the fact that all these other reports demonstrate otherwise, that their talking point remains impervious to actual facts. I mean, I think that at the very least, it should be a contested issue. Mm-hmm. That even if we can't say, no, Hamas doesn't use human shields, right? And by the way, here we have I think we're using human shields incorrectly. In humanitarian law, that's not what's meant by shielding. Shielding is when you actually use the civilians to go into a certain area to protect yourself. This is about mm-hmm. hiding in civilian areas, and that is not legal in humanitarian law. But anyway, the point is this, is that at the very least, this discourse should be subject to contestation. We should mm-hmm. at least say, oh, it's a matter of controversy whether this is done, until mm-hmm. there's an investigation that shows one way or the other. But we never hear that, and two, we never get to an investigation. And the fact that Israel refuses to be investigated, by the way, is not unique to Israel. Every state will refuse an investigation mm-hmm. if it can, and will insist that this is sensitive intelligence that it can't disclose, or that the reviewing body is biased. You know, mm-hmm. consider the U.S. has never subjected itself to any investigation. And the reason that it doesn't have to is because it's so powerful. So the way that the law works isn't that Israel is just so bad. No, states will do as much as they can given the power that they're afforded.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting because I worked in the West Bank for a few years, and I actually saw firsthand multiple times Israeli soldiers actually using Palestinian children as human shields, like literally putting this boy in front of them as they, you know, walk down the street in Nablus, you know, so that they wouldn't get shot. And so the first time I saw that, it was so devastating. I started crying. And, you know, to hear all this in the media, it's just, you know, it really makes me upset.
As it should. I mean, because that's an atrocious use of children. That, you know, you're going to prevent anybody from firing on the soldiers because you want, you're using this child as a hostage. I mean, that is, in fact, the true definition of human shielding. The other thing that one should take into account and is that, you know, there has to be an intentionality of this. Suppose, for example, that in fact, you know, there are Hamas, there is a Hamas leader who is in a neighborhood, say he's in Khan Yunis, right? That doesn't mean that he was shielding himself in the community. To the contrary, there has to be an intentionality. Mm-hmm. Was he in the neighborhood in Khan Yunis because he was visiting his family and having dinner? Or was he in Khan Yunis because he intended to protect himself from attack by Israel? So, you know, this dimension that there has to be intentionality. Otherwise, anywhere that if I have a relationship with anybody who happens to be associated, suddenly I'm guilty of also being the human, voluntarily being the human shield. I mean, this is, we have to be careful about what Israel is trying to do and the bounds that it's pushing. And mind you, that as in the course of its violations and transgressions of law, it's actually shaping what the law is. And so what seems like just Israel's, you know, Israel being above the law has much more serious implications than just that instance.
So what can regular people around the world do to challenge the bias against Palestinians in mainstream media?
Excellent question. So, you know, usually my discussion around international law is international law is basically worth as much as the political will that exists to implement it, right? Or that law is only as powerful as the political will that makes it legitimate. And so there is no law, especially in an international system where, right, there's a false sense of the parity of states. There's strong states and there's weak states. Those states that are prosecuted and those states that act with impunity and define what the law is. And so what the outcome that we'll end up seeing is not gonna be something that lawyers do. It's not going to be something that happens in court. It's not going to be an argument that's written anywhere or a law review article that's drafted. The change happens in political action. The change happens in a discourse that insists on the lack of parity between these two parties. It happens, you know, we continuously go to rallies and, you know, we start to think, what is the point? Nobody's listening. Nobody's doing anything. Yeah. That's just not true. That is all shaping the public perception. That mass mobilization is shaping the way that we're thinking about this, is shaping the political forces, right? Boycott, divestment, and sanction, even if it doesn't have an economic impact, has an impact on the way that we think about these things. Now Israel is on the defensive to defend why it is not a settler colonial state, why it does not discriminate against its Palestinian citizens, why it does not, you know, exercise lawlessness, capriciousness, and arbitrariness against refugees and civilians under occupation. We've placed Israel on the defensive by, you know, using an assertive narrative. So I think that participation in mass mobilization, participation in boycott, divestment, and sanctions, participation in the most localized way possible. So at your co-op, at your place of faith, your institution of faith, as a member of a union, of a teacher's union, for example, or of a dock workers union, as a teacher, as a playwright, as an artist, there is a way for the individual to be part of a mass movement that helps to create the political current that would support the implementation of, you know, the just outcome that we see, oftentimes in this case, underscored by the language of law as well.
Okay, so that really, that's really meaningful to me because I was going to demonstrations for a while and I just kind of stopped because I felt like it doesn't change anything, but, you know, I guess I think you think that it does. So, I want to emphasize that to the listeners out there that, you know, maybe demonstrations, you know, are useful. So given that the taxes of U.S. citizens are going to support Israel, do you think You know, all the things that you mentioned, like the boycott, getting active in your local community, demonstrations, is that the best way to hold Israel accountable, or is there anything else?
I don't know if it's the best way, but it's a very effective way, and it's something that's accessible to everyone and can be reflected very locally. You're part of a global movement that can be articulated very locally, given your own, your student. You can act very locally by pushing on your trustees, for example, to divest from its holdings that perpetuate occupation, colonialism, and, you know, apartheid.
Yeah.
And if you're a teacher, you can push on, you know, your union, if you're part of TIAA-CREF. So it operates in very, if you're part of a member of a church. So here you are combating this huge edifice of U.S. foreign policy, right, and international relations that are beyond our reach, that you can articulate and capture in a very local sense where you're a very empowered agent. So that's why it's so effective. But you can do that in a number of ways. If you're a media worker, you know, building relationships with media is another way to do it. If you are a cultural worker, there are ways to express that in both in participation of cultural boycott, but also just in the production of certain works that reflect Palestinian humanity. There is no shortage of ways to be involved. The frustration we experience, and I think what you're articulating from the frustration with demonstration, is that we can't, there's no tangible outcome. We can't hold it, right? There's no resolution. There's no statement. There's no shift. People's lives on the ground have remained unchanged. And so it's frustrating. And it can be really defeatist. And yet we shouldn't. Because all of these are accumulating in intangible ways that will be useful at the moment that we experience a shift that we just cannot anticipate, right? Could anybody have anticipated that the self-immolation of Hamad Bouazizi, for example, would lead to the removal of Tunisia's Ben Ali, or then subsequently create a domino effect throughout the Arab world of uprising. And I'm not saying, you know, that that's what it would look like, but what I want to emphasize is the unknown, that we can do the work that we have to do and be prepared for that moment, that momentous shift, without being frustrated by the lack of seeing it before us. And the other thing I would emphasize is that in addition to protesting those things that, that we don't want, we also need to be prepared for a shift to anticipate what does it look like afterwards, right? So even that work, that reconciliation work, that works on envisioning futures is also very critical and necessary because it gives people something to hold on to and not just something to be in opposition to.
I just thought of something when we were talking about demonstrations. I wanted to remind the listeners, I'm sure everybody out there is familiar with Bilayin Village in the West Bank. They have been demonstrating every Friday for going on, what, like 6 or 7 years now. And it was only because of that that they were able to get the wall moved so that it wasn't cutting through their olive orchards, and you know they're still dealing with this issue, but you know, people got shot, people died, people were injured, but in the end the demonstrations did make a difference.
A huge difference, because the Israeli court decision on the wall not only was in reference to Bilayin but to several villages that were affected by the route of the wall. And yet we see this outcome in Bilayin because of their political work. So there again, you see that the law on its own is insufficient, right? It's that political work that makes a difference.
Well, thank you very much, Nora. You've explained a lot to me and hopefully a lot to the listeners. And you've definitely inspired me. So hopefully the listeners are also equally as inspired.
Thanks so much for having me, Katie, and this is a fantastic project. So I look forward to seeing it along with the others who participated in the Telesummit.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
It is 5 o'clock p.m. My apologies, we're going to forgo the IMEMC report Palestine today this afternoon so we can get right into the World Socialist website half hour news. Again, thank you for joining me on Mideast Migraines. Be back again next Monday at 3 p.m. Hopefully you'll have summoned up the courage to call into the show so we can talk and make this a little more colorful affair. Also join me, consider joining me at 11 a.m. Saturday for the weekend edition of Mideast Migraines. Bye-bye.